Beach was directing research in those areas, and while he didn't reveal the details of it to me at the time, why he indicated that was their area. And I had, by that time, felt the need of some relief from halogen chemistry. So, though I continue to be fascinated by it, but partial oxidation was something that I was interested in, and we had made some phthalic anhydride by catalytic oxidation in my chemical engineering course at Purdue, and I thought, well, this sounds pretty interesting, so let's think about this one carefully. So they made an offer, and I accepted, with the condition that I work in his group.
Okay. Was their salary offer competitive?
More than, yeah. Okay. Quite good. Can't remember at the time, but it was close to or over $600 a month, which was at the top range that PhDs were then getting.
You started at Standard Oil in 55.
Right.
Moved to Cleveland. What was it? Well, Cleveland's still Midwest. It's not...
Well, yeah. The transition to Cleveland wasn't too difficult. I seemed not to have too much trouble making friends most places, and it was a bigger city than I had ever lived in before, but I was lucky to alight in a nice part of town, and the place where I lived, as we talked at lunch, was only two doors or two blocks down the street from the Grace Lutheran Church. Mm-hmm. So I, having been mostly always a churchgoer, and still am, found my way down there the very first Sunday and made some friends, and so my life in Cleveland was never dull.
What was the group like when you... Well, I guess I have several questions. What was the group like when you joined it, and then on a broader picture of what research was like at Standard Oil at that time?
Well, the group that I joined was a group of approximately, must have been 15 or 20 people, all reporting to Dr. Beach, who had the title of a section supervisor, and largely because of the work that we did, why he, along with the rest of us, advanced through the ranks, and at the time he retired, why he was director of research for polymers, petrochemicals, and new processes. But the original group of 15 or 20 was mostly focused on partial oxidation chemistry, and there was it had its own little analytical branch, which included the infrared capability in the laboratory. And then there was one project which was polymer-related, which had to do with the manufacture of microballoons, which you've probably heard of. Well, microballoons are very, very small, less than 100 micron hollow spheres of plastic which float on oil tanks and help prevent the evaporation of volatiles.
Okay.
That had been accomplished. That was Veach's invention. And at that time, they began working on glass microballoons. So I was never involved in that, but was a good friend of the project leader who worked on it. So I began working in his group.
Were you given a specific assignment when you first started?
Not specific, which was something that really intrigued me. They had identified propylene selective oxidation, or perhaps propane, but more than that, propylene as the area of probably greatest opportunity. And they had made significant progress in a selective catalyst for oxidizing propylene to acrolein. And my task was to read through as many of their reports as I could digest in a three-month period and concoct a suggestion as to how I felt, what kind of research I felt should be done on the further utilization of acrolein, which was, of course, a very reactive intermediate, but not very useful by itself at that point. So, with a little bit of coaching, but largely based on ideas I think I had developed myself, why Dr. Beach and I concluded that we should work on the further oxidation of acrolein to acrylates and acrylic acid derivatives, and or try and selectively epoxidize the double bond to glyceraldehyde, which would have been an intermediate for glycerin. So I took off in those two directions and pursued them simultaneously.
It's intriguing that you were allowed or asked to spend time to come up with your own suggestions at that point.
I felt very good about that. I was taken completely by surprise. And so I was given a desk in an office and as much secretarial help as I needed and access to the library and pretty much left alone, except Frank and the other fellows would come around every other week or so and say, what's new today?
I was going to ask if you had group meetings or seminars or how you communicated amongst yourselves as to what was going on.
Well, within Beach's group, it was small enough that communication was never a problem. We had weekly group meetings for all the senior professionals, doctorals, and higher. And Beach himself was a communicator par excellence. And so there was no problem of any kind there, and there was quite a free interchange of ideas. Within the laboratory, Hughes had each project reviewed annually, and this took the form of a typical project review with transparencies and lectures and so on. And he made quite a thing of these reviews, and it was a chance for the individual investigator to respond to the group as well as to the management about what they had done. I suppose they did the same thing in other companies, but Hughes did it very well. And so that was a method of communicating across disciplinary lines. Within the laboratory, we seem to have overlooked that, or I did. There was the petrochemical research group, which Beach had. There was the mobile fuels research group, which Sam Darling had. And Sam Darling was one of the other people I interviewed on my first trip there, who was a pretty fine organic chemist himself, and graduate of Western Reserve, and spent quite a bit of time explaining things to me. So if I hadn't worked for Beach, I would have worked for Darling. Then there was the heavy products and asphalt research division. Apart from the fuels research division, there was the fuels evaluation, which included the motor laboratories, engine test blocks, and things like that. There was what was called the basic research division, which was headed by Arthur L. Jones, Fletcher Jones, who were doing work in thermal diffusion, some different types of catalytic conversion of materials, and some other things I'm sure I don't remember by now. And then the analytical and library, and a very modest pilot plant division. When we moved from the old Cornell Road Laboratory, which is where this was all occurring, in the fall of 57 to the new research center on Warrensville Road, the structure of the organization remained very much the same through all that period, which I think is a tribute to Hughes's foresight. The main thing that was added at the Warrensville location, where there was room for it, was the a major pilot plant expansion and capability, which by that time was needed because we had made the acrylonitrile invention, which had to be pilot planted.
This is one thing that came up in my discussion yesterday with Edith Flanagan, is that when they moved from Tonawanda to Tarrytown, it was a disruptive influence in the organization, in the research organization. So your move, I mean, the fact that that didn't happen in this case.
No, I think organizationally it was remarkably non-disruptive, perhaps because it was carried out in stages. And the petrochemical group was, in fact, the first to move. And we were in our laboratories and had our advancement scale equipment, or bench scale equipment, as opposed to exploratory scale, if you wish, installed and operating at the time the rest of the groups moved in. But that was Veach. He was always one jump ahead of the rest.
Okay. Do you feel that at that time there was a real emphasis on the part of the company, and I'm not sure how much feeling you had for the higher up administrative part of the company, towards what Willard Dow called patient money and a prayerful attitude that there was time and money to do the exploratory work, or was there more emphasis on direction of work?
Well, I have the impression that that the senior management was very much oriented toward process research and support, because I have completely forgotten and failed to mention that there was a completely different and additional laboratory which was larger than the research laboratory, which was the development laboratory, which was adjacent to the refinery. And there was a complete refinery pilot plant in operation at that time, and related research services and things like that. And there was a little bit of competition, but in general, quite a lot of collaboration between the laboratories. And I made some pretty good friends at that laboratory also, particularly one I remember, Oscar Kropp, who was one of the section managers there, who delighted in exchanging humors with me. So it was pretty good. But I would say that the organization, even at the top levels, and I think I was able to shake hands with several of the vice presidents and the president within the first year of my arrival, was probably because Dr. Hughes was shall I use the word diplomatically, skilled at presenting the research case to the senior management.
Okay.
And a lot of what Ohio achieved has to be, has to take recognition of his skill in guiding programs and people.
I've noticed that the success of a research group often depends on someone being able to sell the senior management on projects and ideas that they have.
Well, I think he was pretty good at that, and he was lucky in having as his superior a fellow of the name of Elliot McConnell, who was senior vice president for manufacturing. And the way Standard Oil of Ohio was organized, except for a small sales tech service operation, come to think of it, not so small, that served the sales department, all of the R&D was in the manufacturing department. And as expected, it was pretty well focused on solving manufacturing problems. But in those days, each oil company was developing its own version of catalysts, reforming, cracking, whatever. And so it was, I guess, not too difficult to do some fairly scientific research based on pretty sound engineering and science in pursuing the catalyst research. And the catalyst background was of great value in my later catalytic research. So there was a combination of fortuitous circumstances. McConnell was especially himself very forbearing and patient with the R&D group about funding and balance of exploratory versus applied research and so on. I have to say, maybe partly by luck, made it easier for him by giving him the acrylate and acrylonitrile processes in a very timely fashion.
Well, that's what I'd like to come back to. You've said that after your 3 months of study, you agreed now on a direction, and within 2 years you were at acrylonitrile. I'm wondering if you could work through some of the details of that time.
Sure. It's fairly well documented, by the way, in a nice article that the Chemical and Engineering News did in 1971, where I was declared one of their chemical innovators. And
okay, I don't have that.
That's a July issue.
Okay.
And
that one we didn't pick up.
It kind of puts the whole picture together. I forget which July issue it was, but I'm sure it was 1971.
Okay.
And the history goes something like this. Of the other the project leaders, I first started work when I was doing this desk work. I reported to another project leader. I was made a project leader approximately a year after I joined the group. And after it was decided that by consensus, I suppose, that acrylic acid derivatives and glycerin precursors would be a good strategy to pursue, why I was allowed to take off in that direction, and I actually pursued essentially two projects at the same time. I've always tried to do that. I think working on one project is a mistake. You can work on too many, but one needs an alter ego even among projects. So when one is a little slow, why, you work on the other one and then alternate back and forth. So that's what I did. Both projects were successful. We were able to epoxidize acrolein in small yields, but a group at Shell Chemical, forget the gentleman's name, I believe he worked for Charlie Adams of catalytic fame at Shell, in all honesty beat us to the draw there and got to the glycerin by an alternate route using a vapor phase Mehrine-Pondorf barely reduction, which you're familiar with, allyl alcohol followed by hydroxylation. Anyhow, we were locally successful at any rate, both projects. The other one, in oxidizing acrolein to acrylic acid, I had, of course, read into the literature and had found that several other companies, carbide distillers at that time, Shell, had been pretty well all over the act there, so the only thing they hadn't done was develop a high-yield process. And a lot of the work had focused on vapor phase processes for oxidation or esterification, and of course those were a total disaster when dealing with something like acrolein. So given the fact that it was a petroleum company with skills in catalysis, why, it was predictable that we would take the vapor phase approach. With a lot of trepidation though, because we were dealing in sort of a technology fog of the times. Catalytic science was nowhere near the stage it was now. This was in the mid-50s, and ESCA had been dreamed of, but there were no machines available. Vapor chromatography had just appeared on the scene. Our first determinations of propylene conversion to various aldehydes, acrolein plus other byproducts such as formaldehyde and acetaldehyde, originally were determined by bubbling the reactor stream through a 2,4-dinitrophenylhydrazone solution and separating the solid and doing an infrared scan to determine differences in banding of the different phenylhydrazones. And so, of course, when the first vapor chromatograph came along, why, that removed all of that and speeded up things immensely. But a couple of the other chemists, notably Jim Callahan and Ernie Milberger and Bob Foreman and Bob Griselli, had done work previously on screening a lot of compounds which in search of a selective agent for selective oxidation of propylene to anything of interest. And they had made acetone and a certain amount of acrolein, which was what had our attention at the time. But I stepped up on the shoulders of giants, I guess you would say, to borrow an expression from the literature, and from their teachings began work in the area of the group 6 metal oxides. And a couple of the fellows, including Callahan especially, and Griselli, had looked at the molybdenum compounds as oxidation agents for propylene to acrolein. And the now famous bismuth phosphomolybdate catalyst had been put together by Callahan and Foreman, I think it was, and shown to give rather remarkable selections and conversions of propylene directed to acrolein. No one seems to have given any thought to acrylic acid, much less acrylonitrile. The idea was to make acrolein and see what could be done with it. And so I, borrowing from them, rather easily developed a series of vanadate and molybdate catalysts, which were in the vapor phase impregnated on or co-gelled with silica, were able to convert acrolein to acrylic acid in commercially attractive yields. And so the marketing group immediately began an investigation into what the opportunities for acrylates were. Acrylates were mostly made at that time by the Roman Hoth technology of adding a CO and an alcohol to acetylene, and which was a process of choice for a long time. And it was a serious contender. We were not sure we'd ever be able to equal it or top it. But we carried forward, and after a while some calculations emerged that acrylic acid via acrolein and propylene was in fact economically viable, and the markets were beginning to look interesting. And Veach was very good in making his persuading his staff to think in terms of the economic and consequences of an impact of their work. So I would have to say that even at that time, a lot of our strategic technical thinking was economically flavored. Pretty powerful combination. So acrylic acid was brought to a suitable place where it could be handed over to Dr. Milberger's group, whose job was a bench scale process simulation and advancement, which we defined as the first level of operation in terms of product and feed quantities, where reactor variables could be assessed and real economically sound. Sound economics would be developed based on yield structures obtained on quantities of material large enough that you were felt confident what you were doing. So at that point, why, the question is what to do with acrylic acid, and everybody knew that the use for acrylic acids was either was mostly acrylates or acrylamide. And so I then pursued further work on the vapor phase esterification of acrylic acid over silica gel, which turned out to be much easier than I had thought, and commercially attractive yields in that area were achieved within a matter of a few months. And so then we had the basis of a petrochemical enterprise. Mm-hmm. And about that time, why, I began to realize that, again, with a lot of encouragement and guidance from Veach and Hughes, that I should start looking for something else to do than acrylic acid and acrylates. So acrylonitrile was always in the background, and so no one had even dared to think that you might do everything in one single reaction or reactor. And so my first approach to acrylic acid or acrylonitrile was a vapor phase conversion of acrylic acid to acrylonitrile with ammonia over a dehydration catalyst. And this work was done knowing that REPI, I believe, in Germany had already explored this chemistry, but not with economically significant results. So my approach to that was really to see if process refinements would lead to something that would make economic sense given low-cost acrylic acid. And it wasn't too long after that that we came across the distiller's work, which had been uncovered in my earlier researches, in which they had explored the conversion of acrylene and ammonia to acrylonitrile. So I repeated some of their work and looked at alternate chemical variations of their catalysts, which might be more economically advantageous because their yields and conversions were in somewhat of improvement. Do we need to change?